watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Carey. The 19th century French social philosopher Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, the first to describe himself as an anarchist, wrote in his essay, What is Property? Quote, property acting by exclusion and encroachment while population was increasing has been the life principle and definitive cause of all revolutions, religious wars and wars of conquest, when they have stopped short of the extermination of races, have been only accidental disturbances, soon repaired by the mathematical progression of the life of nations. The downfall and death of societies are due to the power of accumulation possessed by property, close quote. Last week's speaker, John Marciano, quipped that the liberal sees a man sleeping on the street and says the system isn't working, and a radical sees the same thing and says the system is working. What accounts for such divergent conclusions about the same objective fact? And there are other conclusions as well, such as that the sleeper is lazy, crazy, or addicted to intoxicating substances, or that he is a sinner out of favor with God, or a person with bad karma, in short, some way culpable, and our social system blameless. One's conclusion about the man on the street, therefore, is based on what one believes about the basic nature of the society we live in and what governs its dominant processes. This week, we'll look at its dominant processes and their consequences, intended or unintended, you decide. Apropos that this show is being recorded on Easter Sunday, we'll begin with an excerpt of a sermon on the question of democracy and the future by former seminarian and acclaimed investigative journalist Bill Moyers, who spoke in February at Occidental College in Los Angeles.
I came across the continent to talk to you about two subjects close to my heart. I care about both as a journalist, citizen, and grandfather, who every morning looks at the pictures next to my computer, Henry, age 14, Thomas, 12, Nancy, 10, Jassy, 6, and Sarah Jane, 3, and realizes that they don't have a vote. They don't have a lobbyist in Washington, and they can't make meaningful contributions to a presidential candidate. If I don't speak up in their behalf, who will? And yes, I am indeed that old. I've heard about the beautiful young Oxy Coed who returns from her first blind date and is asked by her roommate, how was it? It was terrible, she answered. He picked me up in a 1932 Rolls Royce. What's so terrible about that? Her roommate asks. He was the original owner. Well, you're looking at the original owner. But age frees us to focus on your obsessions of choice. One of my obsessions, as Diana indicated, is democracy. And the reason I came to Occidental is because there is no campus in the country more attuned to what it's going to take to save democracy for my grandchildren. So I came on a selfish mission to enlist you in their behalf. Because of your record of activism for social justice, I know that you and I agree that democracy is more than what we were taught in high school civics, more than the two-party system, the checks and balances, the debate over whether the Electoral College is a good idea. These are important matters and warrant our attention. But democracy involves something more fundamental. What I have in mind is what democracy bestows on us, the revolutionary idea that democracy isn't just about the means of governance, but the means of dignifying people so that they can become fully free to claim their moral and political agency. We don't have much time. Democracy is in trouble, beginning right here where you live. A recent poll by the Public Policy Institute of California found that only 20% of voters last November believe your state will be a better place to live in the year 25. 51%, over half, say it will be worse. This is an important psychological blow, because if you don't believe in the future, you're not likely to sacrifice for it. I said earlier in the evening that I don't know how to be in the world except to expect a better future, and then to get up every morning to try to do something within my power, no matter how minute it might be, to bring it about. 51% of the people in your state believe that by the year 2025, this will not be a better place to live. Another poll by the New American Foundation, summed up in an article by Stephen Hill in the January 28th San Francisco Chronicle, found that for the first time in modern California history, a majority of adults are not registered with either of the two major parties. They believe that only another party can champion the public interest over private interests. Furthermore, writes Hill, there is a widening breach between most of the 39 million people residing in California and the fewer than 9 million who actually vote. And we're getting here to the heart of the crisis today, which is the great divide in American life. Listen to this. According to that New America Foundation study, frequent voters in California tend to be 45 years and older, have household incomes of $60,000 or more, are homeowners, and have college degrees. In contrast, the 12 million non-voters, 7 million of whom are eligible to vote but are not registered, tend to be younger than 45, rent instead of own, haven't been to college, and have incomes under $60,000. In other words, considering that California often has the lowest voter participation rate in the nation, in some elections, only a little more than one-third of eligible voters participate, a small group of frequent voters who are richer, whiter, and older than their non-voting neighbors form the majority that decides which candidates win and that decides which ballot measures pass. The author of that report concludes, only about 15% of adult people make the decisions in California, and that 15% doesn't look much like California itself. We shouldn't be surprised by the consequences. Two Californias have emerged, one that votes and one that does not. Both sides inhabit the same state. Both sides share the same resources. But only one side is electing the political leaders who divide up the pie. You've got a big problem, people. But don't feel alone. America's in trouble, and it's even deeper than the studies here in California reveal. Our 18th century political system is melting down. Despite Thomas Jefferson's counsel that we would need a revolution every 25 years to enable our governance to serve new generations, our structure, practically deified for 225 years, has essentially stayed the same while science and technology and just about everything else have raced ahead. A young writer I know named Jan Frel, one of the most thoughtful practitioners of the new emerging world of web journalism, wrote me the other day to say, "We've gone way past ourselves. I see the unfathomable numbers in the national debt and deficit. I see the way that the federal government was physically unable to respond to Hurricane Katrina. I look at Iraq, where 50% of the question is how to get out, and the other 50% is how did so few people have the power to start the invasion? If the Republic were functioning," he said, "they would never have had that power." The inertia of the political process seems virtually unstoppable. The chairman of the Senate Budget Committee can shepherd a $2.8 trillion budget through the Senate and then admit, direct quote, "It's hard to understand what a trillion is. I don't know what it is," he said. Well, of course, as Jan said, it's not fair to expect anyone to understand what $1 trillion is, or how to behave with it in any democratic fashion. But the political system and culture are forcing its members of Congress, 535 of them, and a president who are often thousands of miles from their 300 million constituents to do just that. It is frightening to watch the America media culture, from progressive to hard right, being totally sold on the idea of one president for 300 million people, as though the presidency is still fit to human scale. "I'm at a point," says Jan, "where the idea of a political savior in the guise of a presidential candidate or congressional majority sounds downright scary." And at the same time, with very few exceptions, the writers and journalists across the slate are completely sold on it. Our political system is not only primitive, it's promiscuous. The first modern fundraiser in American politics, Mark Hanna, who shook down the corporations to make William McKinley president, once said, "There are two important things in politics. One is money," he said, "and I can't remember what the other one is." Because our system feeds on campaign contributions, the powerful and the privileged shape it at will. Only 12% of American households had incomes over $100,000 in the year 2000, but they made up 95% of the substantial contributions to campaigns, and they've been the big winners since George W. Bush went to the White House. Let me read you something. Quote, "When powerful interests shower Washington with millions in campaign contributions, they often get what they want. But it's ordinary citizens and firms that pay the price, and most of them never see it coming. This is what happens if you don't contribute to their campaigns or spend generously on lobbying. You pick up a disproportionate share of America's tax bill. You pay higher prices for a broad range of products, from peanuts to prescriptions. You pay taxes that, in a similar situation, others have been excused from paying. You must pay debts that you incur while others do not. You're barred from writing off on your tax returns some of the money spent on necessities while others deduct the cost of their entertainment. You must run your business by one set of rules while the government creates another set for your competitors. In contrast, the fortunate few who contribute to the right politicians and hire the right lobbyists enjoy all the benefits of their special status. Make a bad business deal, the government bails them out. If they want to hire workers at below market wages, the government provides the means to do so. If they want more time to pay their debts, the government provides an extension. If they want immunity from certain laws, the government gives it. If they want to ignore rules their competition must comply with, the government gives its approval. If they want to kill legislation that is intended for the public, it gets killed." This is not from Karl Marx, or it's not from Mao's Little Red Book. I'm quoting Time magazine. "From the heart of America's media establishment comes the judgment that America now has, quote, government for the few at the expense of the many. Now, I saw early on when I was a cub reporter on the Marshall News Messenger what happens when a few get the upper hand. I grew up in a little town in East Texas that was half black and half white. The whites counted politically, the blacks didn't. I got my first job in journalism at the age of 16. I'd been working for 2 years as a sacking boy at the A&P food store, and by a stroke of luck, thanks to an English teacher, I wound up getting a job on the newspaper and then had one of those strokes of luck that can determine a career. Some of the old-timers were on vacation or out sick, and I got assigned to cover what came to be known as the Housewives Rebellion. 15 women in my hometown decided not to pay the Social Security tax for their domestic workers. They argued that Social Security was unconstitutional, that imposing it was taxation without representation, and that, here's my favorite part, requiring us to collect the tax is no different from requiring us to collect the garbage. They hired themselves a lawyer, none other than Martin Dies, the former congressman best known, or worse known, for his work as the head of the House Committee on Un-American Activities in the 30s and 40s. He was no more effective at defending rebellious women than he'd been protecting us against communist subversives. And eventually, the women wound up holding their nose and paying the tax. The stories that I wrote for my local paper were picked up and moved on the Associated Press wire to newspapers all over the country. And one day, the managing editor called me over and pointed to the AP ticker beside his desk. Moving across the wire was a notice citing one Bill Moyers and the paper for the reporting we'd done on the rebellion. Well, I was hooked. In one way or another, after a detour through seminary and then into politics and government for a spell, I've been covering politics ever since. And by politics, I mean when people get together to influence government, change their own lives, and change society. Sometimes those people are powerful corporate lobbyists, like the drug companies and the oil industry. Sometimes they're ordinary people fighting to protect their communities from toxic chemicals, workers fighting for a living wage, or, as you know so well, college students organizing to put an end to sweatshops. Those women in Marshall, Texas, who didn't want to pay Social Security taxes for their maids, they were not bad people. They were regulars at church, the church I attended. Their children were my friends. Many of them were active in community affairs. Their husbands were pillars of the business and professional class in town. They were respectable and upstanding citizens, all. So it took me a while to figure out what had brought on that spasm of reactionary rebellion. And it came to me one day, much later. They simply could not see beyond their own prerogatives. Fiercely loyal to their families, to their clubs, their charities, and congregations, fiercely loyal, in other words, to their own kind, they narrowly defined membership in democracy to include only people like them. The women who washed and ironed their laundry, wiped their children's bottoms, made their husbands' beds, and cooked their family meals, these women too would grow old and frail, sick and decrepit, lose their husbands and face the ravages of time alone, with nothing to show from their years of labor but the crease in their brow and the knots on their knuckles. In one way or another, this is the oldest story in America. The struggle to determine whether we, the people, is a spiritual idea embedded in a political rally, reality, one nation, indivisible, or merely a charade masquerading the ability of the powerful and the privileged to milk the system for their own advantage. We seem to be holding our breath today, trying to decide what kind of country we want to be. But in this state of suspension, powerful interests are making off with our democracy. They remind me of the card shark in Texas who said to his competitor in the poker game, "Now play the cards fair, Reuben. I know what I dealt you." For years now, a small fraction of American households has been garnering a larger and larger concentration of wealth and income. While large corporations and financial institutions have obtained unprecedented power over who wins and who loses, inequality in America is greater than it's been in 50 years. In 1960, when I went to work in the Kennedy administration, the gap in terms of wealth between the top 20% of Americans and the bottom 20% was 30-fold. Today, it's more than 75-fold. Now, such concentrations of wealth would be far less of an issue if the rest of society were benefiting proportionally. But that's not the case. Throughout our industrial history, incomes grew at a rate of 30 to 50% or more every quarter. And in the quarter century after World War II, my quarter century, gains reached more than 100% for all income categories. But since the late 1970s, only the top 1% of households have increased their income by 100%. Once upon a time, according to Isabel Sawhill and Sarah McClanahan in the journal called The Future of Children, the American ideal of a classless society was one in which all children have a roughly equal chance, regardless of the economic status of the family into which they were born. My friend, the economist Jeffrey Madrick, wrote recently that just a couple of decades ago, only 20% of one's future income was determined by the income of your father. New research suggests that today, 60% of a son's income is determined by the level of his father's income. In other words, children no longer have a roughly equal chance of success in America, regardless of the economic status of the family into which they are born. This means your chances of success are better if you're born on third base and your father has been tipping the umpire. As all of you know, a college education today is practically a necessity if you're to hold your own, much less to climb to the next rung. More than 40% of all new jobs in the American economy require a college degree. And there are real-world consequences to this. Since the 1970s, media wages of men with college degrees have risen about 14%. Women are roughly the same. But median wages for high school graduates have fallen by 15%. And nearly 24% of American workers with only a high school diploma have no health insurance, compared with less than 10% of those with college degrees. Now, I know that such statistics can cause the eyes to glaze over. But Oscar Wilde once said that it is the mark of a truly educated person to be deeply educated by statistics. And because all of you are educated, I know you can envision the stress these economic realities are putting on working people and on family life. As incomes have stagnated, higher education, health care, public transportation, drugs, housing, and cars have risen faster in price than typical family incomes, so that life has grown neither calm nor secure for most Americans by any means. Let me tell you about the Stanleys and the Newmans. I spent much of a decade with the Stanleys and the Newmans. There are two families who live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. One is black, the other white. The breadwinners in both families lost their jobs in the first wave of downsizing in 1991 as corporations began moving jobs out of the city, out of the state, and then out of the country. In a documentary series over the next decade, my colleagues and I chronicled their efforts to cope with these wrenching changes in their lives and to find a place for themselves in the new global economy. They're the kind of people my mother over in Marshall, Texas, would have called the salt of the earth. They love their children. They care about the communities. They go to church on Sunday. They work hard all week. To make ends meet after the layoffs, both moms had to take full-time jobs. both dads became seriously ill. When one father had to stay in the hospital 2 months, the family went $30,000 in debt because they didn't have adequate health care. We were present with our cameras when the bank began foreclosure on the modest home of one family that couldn't make its mortgage payments. Like millions of Americans, the Stanleys and the Newmans were playing by the rules and still getting stifled. By the end of the decade, they were slipping further behind while running harder, and the gap between them and prosperous Americans was widening. What turns their personal tragedy into a political travesty is that they are patriotic, but they no longer believe that they matter to the people who run the country. They simply don't think their concerns would ever be addressed by the governing class or given serious attention by media elites. Now, they're not cynical. They're too religious to be cynical. But they know the system is rigged against them. And it's true. The British journalist George Orwell said, "Things have reached such a state of affairs that the first duty of every intelligent person is to pay attention to the obvious." Let me call your attention to the obvious, although you don't have to take my word for it, or the word of Karl Marx. Just read The Economist. That's right. The pro-business magazine, considered by many to be the most influential defender of capitalism on the newsstands. Its editors produced a sobering analysis of what is happening to the old notion that any mother's child in America can get to the top. A growing body of evidence, some of it I've already cited, led the editors to conclude that with income inequality reaching levels not seen since the Gilded Age and social mobility falling behind, the United States, and this is a direct quote, risks calcifying into a European-style class-based society. The editors point to an education system increasingly stratified by social class, in which poor children attend schools with fewer resources than those of their richer contemporaries. They point to great universities that are increasingly, and this is a direct quote, reinforcing rather than reducing those educational inequalities. And they conclude that America's great companies have made it harder than ever for people to start at the bottom and rise up the company hierarchies by dint of hard work and self-improvement. I mean, it is eerie to read assessments like that and then turn to the book by the anthropologist Jared Diamond called Collapse: How Societies Choose Failure or Success. Diamond describes an American society in which elites cocoon themselves in gated communities guarded by private security patrols and filled with people who drink bottled water, depend on private pensions, and send their children to private schools. Gradually, he says, the elites lose their motivation to support the police force, the municipal water supply, Social Security, and public schools. And any society contains a blueprint for failure, warns Jared Diamond, if elites insulate themselves from the consequences of their own actions. No wonder. No wonder that in a study of its own, the American Political Science Association found that increasing inequalities threaten the American ideal of equal citizenship and that progress toward real democracy may have stalled in this country and even reversed. Unless we act, this new social Darwinism in our time will return us to those blessed days when the strong take what they can and the weak suffer what they must. This is a marked turn for a country whose mythology embraces life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for everyone. America was not supposed to be a country where winner takes all. That's for football and basketball and other sports. It's not for democracy. Through our system of checks and balances, we were going to maintain a healthy equilibrium in how power works and for whom it works. Because equitable access to public resources is the lifeblood of any democracy, we made primary schooling free to all, as I believe higher education should be free to all. Because everyone deserves a second chance. Debtors in America, especially the relatively poor, were protected by state laws against their rich creditors. Government encouraged Americans to own their own piece of land and even supported squatters' rights. In my time, the hope of opportunity became reality for millions. Although my parents were knocked down and out by the Great Depression, my father never made more than $100 in any job he ever had a week, and he never made that until the last 7 years of his working life when he joined a union. Although they were knocked down and kept down and were poor all their lives, my brother and I went to good public schools. The GI Bill made it possible for him to go to college. When I bought my first car with a loan of $450, I drove to a public school on a public highway and stopped to rest in a public park. America, as a shared project, was becoming the engine of our national experience and the promise of our future. Until now, beginning a quarter century ago, a movement of corporate, political, and religious fundamentalists gained ascendancy over politics and made inequality its goal. They launched a crusade to dismantle the political institutions, the legal and statutory canons, and the intellectual and cultural frameworks that have held private power publicly responsible. You can understand why Franklin Roosevelt feared a government by money as much as he feared a government by the mob. And you can understand why the Stanleys and the Newmans were turned off by politics. They and millions like them have been losers in a class war that first disarmed them of political influence and then defeated them, betrayed them, subverted them in the corridors of power. Americans don't like this word, but it was a class war that was declared a generation ago in a polemic by the wealthy right-winger William Simon, who had been Richard Nixon's Secretary of the Treasury. In a book called A Time for Truth, he declared that, quote, funds generated by business must rush by the multi-millions to conservative causes. It was a trumpet sounded for the financial and business class to take back the power and privileges they had lost as a result of the Depression and the New Deal. They got the message, and soon they were waging a well-orchestrated, lavishly financed movement. Business Week put it very bluntly. Some people, it said, will have to do with less. It will be a bitter pill for many Americans to swallow the idea of doing with less so that big business can have more. Their long-range strategy was to cut workforces and their wages, scour the globe in search of cheap labor, trash the social contract and the safety net that was supposed to protect people from hardship beyond their control, deny ordinary citizens the power to sue rich corporations for malfeasance and malpractice, and eliminate the ability of government to restrain what the Wall Street Journal admiringly called the animal spirits of business. Looking backwards, it all seems so clear, so obvious, to quote Orwell, that we wonder how we could have ignored the warning signs at the time. What has been happening to working people is not the result of Adam Smith's invisible hand, but the direct consequence of corporate activism, intellectual propaganda, the rise of a religious literalism opposed to any civil and human rights that threaten its paternalism, and a string of political decisions favoring the interests of wealthy elites who bought the political system right out from under us. To create the intellectual framework for this revolution in public policy, they funded conservative think tanks that churned out study after study advocating their agenda. To put muscle behind these ideas, they created a formidable political machine. One of the few journalists to cover the issues of class in my time, Thomas Edsel of the Washington Post, reported that during the 1970s, business refined its ability to act as a class, submerging competitive instincts in favor of joint cooperative action in the legislative area. Big business political action committees flooded the political arena with a deluge of dollars, and they built alliances with the religious right, Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority and Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition, who gleefully contrived a cultural holy war that became a smokescreen behind which the economic assault on the working and middle classes, their own congregations, would occur. From land and water and other natural resources, to media and the broadcast and digital spectrums, to scientific discovery and medical breakthroughs, a broad range of America's public resources has been undergoing a powerful shift toward elite control, contributing substantially to those economic pressures on ordinary Americans that deeply affect household stability, family dynamics, social mobility, political participation, and civic life. It's time to fight back. Hear me. Hear me on this. The only answer to organized money is organized people. Again, the only answer to organized money is organized people. Again, the only answer to organized money is organized people. So I have come here to Occidental because you have a reputation for believing in a political system where ordinary people have a voice in making the decisions that shape their lives, not just at the ballot box every 2 years or 4 years in November, but in their workplaces, their neighborhoods and communities, and on their college campuses. In a real democracy, ordinary people at every level hold their elected officials accountable for the big decisions about whether to go to war and send young men and women in harm's way, about the pollution of the environment, global warming, the health and safety of our workplaces, our communities, the air and water, the quality of our public schools, and the distribution of our economic resources. It's the spirit of fighting back throughout American history that brought an end to sweatshops, won the 8-hour working day and a minimum wage, delivered suffrage to women and blacks from slavery, inspired the gay rights movement, the consumer and environmental movements, and more recently stopped Congress from enacting repressive legislation against immigrants. I believe that a new wave of social reform is about to break out across America. We've seen it in the struggle for a living wage for America's working people. Last November, voters in 6 states approved ballot measures to raise their state's minimum level above the federal level. 28 states now have such laws, and since 1994, more than 100 cities have passed local living wage laws that require employers who do business with the government, that is, who get taxpayer subsidies, to pay workers enough to lift their families out of poverty. Los Angeles, as you know, has led the way, passing one of the nation's strongest living wage laws in 1997. And just the other day, the Los Angeles City Council voted to extend that living wage law to the 3,500 hotel workers around the Los Angeles airport. The first living wage in the country to target a specific industry and a specific geographic area. But it took last year's march down Century Boulevard, organized people, to finally bring it about. And it took the arrest of hundreds of college students, including several dozen from Occidental. It will take a lot more if we are to restore the promise of democracy to all Americans and save our future from our grandchildren. The great abolitionist Frederick Douglass taught us that if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess freedom yet fail to act, they are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand, said Douglass. It never did, and it never will. We're talking here about a broad movement emerging for democracy. It happened in 1800 with Jeffersonian Democrats. It happened in 1860 with radical Republicans. It happened in 1892 with the populists, in 1912 with Bull Moose progressives, in 1932 with New Deal Democrats, and in the 1960s with civil rights activists, each moment a breaking point after long, hard struggles, each with small beginnings in transcendent faith. I've been a journalist too long to look at the world through rose-colored glasses. I believe the only way to be in the world is to see it as it really is and then to take it on despite what you see. The Italian philosopher Gramsci called this the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will. And that's why I believe your generation will bring about the third American Revolution. The first won independence from the crown. The second won equal rights for women and the sons and daughters of slavery. This third, the revolution of the 21st century, will bring about a democracy that leaves no one out. Because the simple truth is we cannot build a political society or a nation across the vast social divides that mark our country today. We must bridge those divides and make society whole, sharing the fruits of freedom and prosperity with the least among us. I've come to tell you, across the continent, the dream is not done, the work is not over, and your time has come to take it on. Thank you.
You've been listening to Bill Moyers speaking in February to students at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Thanks to Voices for Global Justice for that recording. One main theme of Moyer's talk was the extent to which the structure of American government's checks and balances fails in its stated purpose to prevent abuses of power. The failure of Congress, even when in the hands of an opposition party, to hold the administration of George Bush and Dick Cheney accountable for a laundry list of offenses by implementing the procedures provided by law is an example of this. For that reason, a coalition of 25 national groups has called for a spring impeachment drive aimed at the corporate power behind the throne. One of the main spokespeople for this campaign is Project Censored's Peter Phillips, who, along with Dennis Liu, is author of a recent book, Impeach the President, The Case Against Bush and Cheney. They've been speaking around the country on the importance of pushing for impeachment as soon as possible to end the war. Part of this effort is a national corporate shopping boycott to take place from April 15th, Tax Day, to April 22nd, Earth Day, to end the war in Iraq and impeach Bush and Cheney. They have a website at www.wearenotbuyingit.org. They're asking people to suspend corporate shopping for 1 week by delaying major purchases, avoiding chain stores and shopping malls, and finding local retailers and small business owners to support. Their message to corporate America, "We are not buying it," is a response to Bush's declaration after 9/11 to quietly go shopping. They say, "We are not going to be quiet in the face of torture, WMD lies, civil liberty losses, and hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths." I received an email from Peter Phillips asking me to endorse the boycott. I do. You can find out more about Impeach for Peace, the National Corporate Shopping Boycott, April 15th through 22nd, to end the war and impeach Bush and Cheney at www.wearenotbuyingit.org and at impeachthepresidentnow.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Lauren Goldner is an activist and writer whose work examines the relationship between political and economic institutions nationally and globally. His many books and essays include The Remaking of the American Working Class and Continuity and Discontinuity in the Decline of Dollar-Centered World Accumulation. His recent article, Fictitious Capital and the Transition Out of Capitalism, is the subject of a recent interview by Bonnie Faulkner, host of an excellent show that airs on KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California, Guns and Butter. Here's Bonnie Faulkner.
Lauren, you've written that U.S. foreign policy is in crisis. Certainly it has looked for a long time like the United States is conducting permanent war abroad. What, in your opinion, is the main driving force behind these wars?
Well, I think that the best way to think about it is in terms of a leap forward or kind of a running forward to avoid a crisis in the rear. And this involves basically a huge crisis of the U.S. economy, of which we're starting to see very immediate consequences, such as in the subprime mortgage crisis. But this has been going on now for decades. And what it ultimately involves, what I'd like to talk about today, is this huge credit pyramid, which has kept the U.S. economy and the world economy going artificially now since really at least the 1970s.
Well, are you talking about an inflationary credit bubble?
Yes. Basically, the situation of the current world economy is one in which there is a tremendous amount of what I call fictitious capital. That's a term borrowed from Karl Marx, used by many other people, but not generally part of mainstream discussion of the economy. And by fictitious capital, I mean capital investments, demands for return in either the form of profit or interest or rent that really don't correspond to any kind of production in the what we could call the real economy. That's a somewhat loaded term we can unpack. And over time, since the late 1950s, really, but really accelerating since the early 1970s, the U.S. economy, through its financial system, has generated a historically unprecedented amount of this fictitious capital. It circulates just like normal capital circulates. And I want to quickly point out that there's no real boundary between this fictitious capital and real capital, but they coexist side by side. And to the typical mainstream point of view, economists, policymakers, they're indistinguishable, but they require profit. And if that profit doesn't come from normal capitalist production, it has to come from what I call loot. And loot being something that is essentially a free input to the system. Now, what is a free input to the system? One very common form is the importation of labor from other sectors of the world economy, and most notably in Europe and in North America, that's immigrant labor recruited from rural economies in Latin America, or in the case of Europe, the Middle East, or Africa. Another free input is the simple looting of nature, destruction of nature, say, for example, in the form of strip mining that produces a profit for a local capitalist, but at the same time produces huge social costs that are not paid for by that capitalist, but are paid for by society as a whole, or not paid for at all. So that is the fundamental process that I see going on today, that as this credit pyramid has become larger and larger, more and more of that looting has become necessary. I want to add that in addition to those free inputs, if you want to use a kind of technocratic term, there is also a form of looting internal to the system, and that is driving the wages of ordinary working people down below the level at which they can reproduce themselves, that is, have families, raise another generation of workers, or destroying existing plant and infrastructure, first of all, by overuse, and then secondly, by non-replacement. Again, the U.S. economy is an excellent example of that, where it's been a while since I've seen the exact figures, but it's estimated that something like $3 to $4 trillion of infrastructure replacement would be necessary, from, you know, the Chicago sewer system that burst several years ago and created huge amounts of damage, from an initial glitch that would have cost about $1,200 to repair. And anybody who's familiar with American cities can think of their own examples of that. So there's an external kind of pull into the system of labor and materials that aren't paid for. At the same time, there's a grinding down in the system of what we would call normal reproduction. Of course, by normal, I merely mean normal in capitalist terms, not necessarily normal in human terms.
So would you say then that the system is cannibalizing itself, that it's not going to be able to infinitely reproduce itself?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I think if we look at the U.S. economy over the last 40 or 50 years, we can see this very clearly. Just to take one example, in the New York public school system, a city where I've lived for 5 or 10 years, there used to be an excellent system of elementary schools and high schools through which working class children would go to college and wind up in what Americans call the middle class. Now, again, I'm using these terms guardedly just to talk about a certain kind of social mobility. And over the last 30 or 40 years, that whole system has been interrupted and basically turned into one in which a huge number of kids are basically in dead-end situations and drop out of school, knowing full well that they have no future in the broader society. In France, where in 2005 there were riots in the suburbs of Paris of similar kids, in this case mainly immigrants, who were similarly cut off, they used the metaphor of the breaking of the social escalator. So that's simply one example of what I would call non-reproduction in society. That is, in a certain period of its history, a myth of America, a working-class child, had a certain opportunity to rise socially. And I would say that, by and large, this has been turned into a very elite system.
Now, you've written that the worldwide boom is a result of a huge credit creation by the United States. How does the United States create credit?
Okay. Basically, following World War II, the United States replaced Great Britain as the world creditor. And that, in fact, had been going on since World War I, but just kind of episodically and sporadically. And the important result of World War II was to make the dollar into what's called an international reserve currency. And right at the end of World War II, the dollar had this reputation of being as good as gold. Now, what it meant in practice was that central banks around the world did not just accumulate gold out of international trade, they accumulated dollars and held them just in the same way they held gold. You can think of it as kind of a big poker game in which wins and losses are distributed around in the form of chits, and those chits today are literally dollars. And what was kind of novel about this system was that it gave the U.S. an ability to not only perform credit operations in its own domestic economy, but to essentially inflate or deflate the world economy. Now, starting in the late 1950s, this system became problematic for a simple reason, that the U.S. began to import more goods from abroad than it was exporting, and its competitive position, which after World War I was huge, that is hugely advantageous, began to deteriorate under competition from countries like Germany and a few years later from Japan, so that America's trade deficits began to produce dollars held in other central banks. And at the same time, inflation began to take off in the United States. So for the first time, the world was experiencing in a small way what it is now experiencing in a gigantic way. Namely, they're holding these pieces of green paper, these chits of the system, at the same time that their value is eroding through domestic inflation in the United States. We can see this very clearly right now, where just a few days ago, the head of the Federal Reserve System, Benjamin Bernanke, testified before Congress that the Fed, as the Federal Reserve System is called, still is concerned about an inflationary bias in the U.S. economy and will not be reducing interest rates anytime soon. This is exactly what these international holders of dollars are concerned about, and above all, the Asian central banks, the big central banks of China, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, who hold altogether something on the order of $2 trillion, are saying to themselves, well, we have these dollars, we mainly invest them in U.S. assets, and above all, U.S. government assets like treasury bills. And at the same time, we see inflation in the U.S. Creeping up every quarter. How much longer are we going to hang on to these green pieces of paper as their value deteriorates? One can think of this international position of the dollar today something like a hot potato or a bag of hot air, something that nobody wants to really hold on to for too long. The dilemma in which foreign countries, foreign central banks, China, first of all, are caught is, on one hand, because of their very positive trade balance with the U.S., which has been very seriously deindustrialized over decades, going back probably again to the late 1950s. They have deteriorating assets, and at the same time, because so much of their trade goes to the United States, fills up the shelves at Walmart, they have an interest in a certain stability of the dollar. So it's something like a kind of a mafia con game where if I owe you $1,000, I'm in trouble, but if I owe you $1,000,000, you're in trouble. You have an interest in my ongoing solvency. So the way in which this problem gets papered over is simply that these foreign creditors of the United States continue to recycle those dollars into American assets, American capital markets, and, as I said a moment ago, above all, into American government paper, which allows the whole game to continue with that inflow of foreign funds. The U.S. is currently borrowing $2 to $3 billion a day to maintain its indebted situation in the world, to keep the whole credit system moving. And with this inflow of foreign funds, the Federal Reserve System and the U.S. Treasury just continue to reflate the economy, create new forms of credit in the U.S. Now, how does this connect up with the social deterioration that I was talking about? Because this money goes out into the economy and requires profit in different forms, that profit has to come from somewhere. And what it means essentially is that things that appear to capitalists, individual capitalists, but above all the capitalist class as a whole, that are considered superfluous, say like education or social services, they have to be cut. And anybody who's been conscious for the last 3 or 4 decades knows that they've been cut very badly.